This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett. Right now we're with the base commander, Colonel Charles Bell. Hi, Charles.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good. Always a pleasure to come on base and see you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for driving out, and always great to see you.
As you know, the reason I decided to come on base today has to do with Veterans Day. And Veterans Day is more complex than one would think, like you were alluding to before we started rolling, and that's it. Even if you're not a veteran, it's still a part of your makeup.
Yeah, I think so, especially within our organization, United States Army Garrison, Fort Hunter Liggett. So Veterans Day has significance to me. It's had significance to me because I served, and to our military population that is currently here that serves, obviously it has a direct significance.
Hunter Liggett is an Army Reserve training base, right?
It is.
So
it,
implicit within people who are serving here is they're part-time civilian, part-time active.
They are, yes. Just like I'm an Army Reserve officer, but I'm on active duty. So again, you know, we have a contingent of our workforce that is active duty, such as myself, probably about 30 of us. It's a relatively small number. And then of the 330 civilians that work for us, about 50% of those civilians had some previous service prior to becoming a Department of the Army civilian and working here at Fort Hunter Liggett. And of the other 50%, you know, for one reason or another, they never had an opportunity to serve. But when they join the civil service, they swear an oath, and in a sense, they are serving now because they recognize the service and sacrifice that our soldiers have given for our freedom, and they swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, just as I did. So it's just a great dynamic all the way around.
When I mention the name Veterans Day, what first comes to your mind?
What first comes to my mind are those veterans that are currently serving, whether it's still Iraq or Afghanistan, because we still have contingents of folks in Iraq or Afghanistan, or at some other location that are out there currently serving. Then the next thing that comes to mind is the families of those service members that are currently serving in Iraq and Afghanistan or some other faraway land where they're separated from their families. And, you know, the moms and dads that won't be at the soccer games, you know, the homework that's getting done by one parent or a grandparent if you're in a dual military family. Just the insurmountable sacrifice that's occurred.
And I think one dynamic that we've talked about in the past, that if you want to shut down the Army, have the spouses go on strike.
Yeah, that's a great point and a great statement. I've not heard it framed that way, but I'll tell you that's the truth. If there is a soldier within our Army that his spouse or loved one is not on board, he probably will not be in the Army very long.
I think the spouses, they do double duty, and they don't get the kudos for that.
They do. I tell you, any spouse that has gone through a deployment with a soldier, we have the easy job. I tell everybody that. We get the easy job. I mean, we get to focus on our mission. We're around, I call it our friends, our colleagues. But you form relationships, friendly relationships, and we call them battle buddies. You have your battle buddies and a group of folks, and you're out working together to execute that mission. You have that frame of reference, and that's your focus. And everything that you did to support your family, obviously, all falls on one spouse at that point. And so it's a harder role to fall into. For the vast majority of spouses, they're concerned about the safety of their loved ones that are deployed. I got to tell you, as a soldier and officer that's deployed a couple different times, that's not my first concern when I'm out there. My first concern is what I have to accomplish for my unit and my fellow soldiers and officers to be successful. You know, we've trained for adversity. But for the unknown, for the spouses that are home, that unknown, it kind of brings some anxiety on top of having to do double duty. So, you know, it's a balance, but they really have the harder job.
Looping back to Fort Hunter Liggett specifically and veterans, I would say every week I encounter a vet somewhere. If Hunter Liggett comes up, they go, oh, my God, you know, I was serving in Fort Ord and during the Vietnam War and we trained up here. This base goes back seven decades, so you have a huge cadre of veterans around America Hunter Liggett, it means a lot.
That's a good point, and I'm equally impressed by the reputation that Fort Hunter Liggett has earned over the years. I know we're running up to our 80th birthday here relatively soon, so there is that bench of folks that have served throughout our military, throughout our Army in particular, that have spent time here at Fort Hunter Liggett for one reason or another. I run into Army Reserve officers that are now senior colonels and general officers that served here when they were in the 7th Infantry Division at Fort Ord and had trained here, and they have stories about the mud during the rainy season and how difficult and rigorous the training was here. And so I get to see it firsthand as the installation or the garrison commander here, and it's just unique. It's a unique position to be in.
Talk to us about how the veterans stay connected with Fort Hunter Liggett.
Yeah, so what's interesting about that is there are a couple of different groups on Facebook, and there's our governmental Fort Hunter Liggett page, in which we publish information related to the installation. And then there's a Fort Hunter Liggett group that, in addition, publishes information related to, like, years gone by at Fort Hunter Liggett. But those folks subscribe to our page, too. You know, I think our folks that subscribe to our page is up to about 21,000 folks. And a lot of that is soldiers that have trained here in the past, unit leaders that have been, you know, commanders in the past. You know, it doesn't matter, I guess, if they're here training now or they trained here back in 1950. Typically, they're a member of our page as well as some of the older pages that really keep up on the historical events that have occurred here.
I think for a veteran, forever, those moments stay with them. And for the Facebook, for example, is a great way to keep connected.
And I can just reflect on my own experience that I can remember the details about everywhere I have trained and deployed. I don't know why. Obviously, it's because it's significant, but, you know, my short-term memory sucks. But if you ask me anything about my deployment to Iraq, Afghanistan, my time at Fort Bliss preparing to deploy, my time at Fort Dix at a annual training, or Fort McCoy or Fort Hunter Liggett, I can tell you the intimate details of those exercises and operations. And I think it's because you're doing what you're drawn to do. You're enthusiastic about serving your country and the people of the United States. It's of significance. And it's kind of like when your first child's born. You kind of remember that, right? It's a significant event for you, or your wedding. And I think for every soldier, every veteran that served, they kind of have the same memory when it comes to who they've served with, where they've served, and what they've accomplished as a veteran in our military.
I'm going to turn the table on you for a moment and talk about Colonel Charles Bell's military journey. Did you start out in ROTC? Why did you join? And how did you wind up a bird colonel?
Yeah, so it's kind of a unique story in the sense that I was born to a family that wasn't really well off. You know, my mom and dad are from Eastern Ohio. They're blue-collar workers. And so as we started talking about what my future was when I was graduating from high school, it was really drawn to the military. So I enlisted in the Army.
As an enlisted?
Yeah. Yeah, as an enlisted soldier in 1990. So I was on the delayed entry program, you know. And
so you could go to school?
Right. So I was finishing high school. I was in my senior year of high school, kind of wrapping that up. And then it was like 3 days after graduation, I went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and completed basic training. And then following that, I went to Fort Gordon, Georgia, and I completed my AIT, which is my technical training, as a signal soldier. I was a 31 Charlie at the time, which was the MOS that corresponded with my job, my occupation. And so that was like one phase of my career. And then I went back and I was in the Army Reserve. So I went back, was in the Army Reserve.
When you were reserve, what were you doing in civilian life?
Yeah, so I went back home. I was a reserve soldier.
Staff sergeant at that time?
I was a private. Private E1. And so I had this epiphany as, I think, an E4, E5. I got selected to drive the battalion commander. So I was the battalion commander's driver. That's what my role was. The position was a signal position. And I guess they thought that I looked apart. And, you know, and they were like, hey, Specialist Bell, you're going to be the battalion commander's driver. So I actually had an opportunity to drive the battalion commander for several years. And throughout my time as his driver, he was coaching me and mentoring me into considering becoming an officer.
So you went OCS then?
No, I went to ROTC. I joined ROTC. So I was in the first couple of years of my college experience, you know, again, having this experience as I drove the battalion commander, coaching and mentoring. And so he had said, hey, when you go back to campus, go visit the ROTC detachment. I think you'll really enjoy it. And so I did, and then I joined Ohio University ROTC, and I became a became an officer.
So then you went active, right?
Yeah, so I was a reserve officer probably through the rank of senior first lieutenant, almost captain. And when I say reserve officer, I'm still a reserve officer, but I was a reserve officer that was not on active duty. I was a material manager as a civilian. I worked for a company at the time called Mosler Safe and Vault. If you've ever heard of them, they're
legendary.
Yeah. I worked there in Hamilton, Ohio.
Go to any bank and there they are.
Exactly, yeah. I worked in procurement. I was a strategic purchasing analyst for that company. I worked there, and then I worked for General Electric, the aircraft engine division. I lived in Cincinnati, did some things there, and then the opportunity came to come on active duty as an AGR officer, still a reserve officer on active duty. So I spoke to my wife, and we made the decision, and that's what we've been doing since.
So you left out a part. You were deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq, correct?
Oh, yeah. I actually never got there in my career yet. I didn't leave it out. I just never got there in my career yet. So when I went on active duty, my first assignment was in Texas. I was a newly promoted captain.
And that's Fort Bliss?
No, it was Austin, Texas, and I was assigned as the plans officer for the 980th Engineer Battalion located in Austin, Texas. Uh-huh. And they were at Camp Mabry, which is a National Guard enclave that's just kind of outside of Austin. Again, a reserve unit, and I'm AGR, so my purpose in life is to support that reserve unit, AGR, Active Guard Reserve.
AGR, got it.
Right. And so I got there, and the unit was notified to deploy probably about 8 months after I arrived.
And what year was this?
I would say that was around 2003. 2002, 2003.
And to where did you deploy?
So I deployed to Iraq. And so I got the opportunity. Originally, I went and I was the plans officer for about a year. I received the opportunity to command a company in Iraq. And so the battalion commander selected me to do that. And it was a great opportunity. So I got to be a company commander for my first deployment, which was awesome. And we deployed to Taji, Iraq, and we did great things in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom 2 in the 1st Cavalry Division. And so that's who we were attached to for that deployment.
Some of the specific things that you did.
Yeah, so we expanded Taji, Iraq, and we did what was called a helipad expansion project to allow a larger aviation unit to base there. During their elections, much like ours, we upgraded polling stations and secured election sites so that the Iraqi people could have the right to vote. So those are some of the significant operations that stick with me. There are many, many more, whether it's fortifying installations and checkpoints. We upgraded a park in downtown Baghdad to give, because the 1st Cavalry Division wanted to give that park back to the people. So we upgraded that park, and there was a big ceremony where that park was given back to the people of Baghdad, Iraq.
It's interesting when you think about it. The troops involved in Hearts and Minds undertaking, it's not the stuff of headlines.
No, it's not. So just like that, that was, as you said, Hearts and Minds. That was a kind of a feel-good mission, mm-hmm. In a sense that,
well,
you know.
A friend of mine was in Vietnam, and he was a CB, and the whole time he was building schools.
Yeah.
As an active duty troop. You know, who would think?
Yeah, and we do that quite a bit. You know, even when we're not deployed, when we're training, we do what's called overseas deployment training, where we'll go to foreign countries such as Guatemala,
Costa Rica,
Guatemala, or over in the Pacific, and we'll actually construct schools and things of that nature, and then that provides a location for the kids to be educated.
Right. Okay, so at some point you rotated out of Iraq, came home, and then you wound up getting orders for Afghanistan.
Yeah, so you really have to flash forward through three assignments, right? So I came back from Iraq, and I found out that I was selected to command another company. So I went and commanded another company, the 459th Multi-Role Bridge Company in Bridgeport, West Virginia. Then I left that assignment, and I was a operations officer in the G3, which is the operations section of the 412th Theater Engineer Command in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And that was a great assignment, by the way. And then I rotated out of that assignment, and I went back to the 980th Engineer Battalion in Austin, Texas, as the operations officer, which is a major position, S3. And I deployed that battalion to Afghanistan.
Uh-huh. And what year was that?
So that was around 2010, 2011.
How long were you in country in Afghanistan?
So I went back to the battalion in 2010. We deployed in 2011. We were there a year, 365 days to the day. We rotated back home right around November of 12.
So here you are today on the largest Army Reserve training base in the United States. What does those experiences in both Iraq and Afghanistan bring to the table for you as a commanding officer of a training facility?
I will say that I had a couple other assignments after that, and one of them was commanding one of the largest Army Reserve Engineer Battalions in Miami, Florida, which is the 841st Engineer Battalion. And that really has significance to my position here because I always have a frame of reference for what my battalion needed to train on, what as a battalion commander I was thinking about as I started to prepare my battalion to go to training. And then I can reflect on those skills that allowed us to be successful in both Afghanistan and Iraq. As an operations officer in the battalion during my second deployment, my role there was really to make sure the battalion could deploy, operate effectively and safely. So again, I can pull from that experience. So really, there's not one assignment. It's a whole experience of assignments that you draw on. And so when you look at training ranges and projects, which have been my priority since I arrived here, because there is none other, right? We exist for one thing, and that is to support the commanders that come here to train, the commanders and soldiers that come here to train. And everything flows off of that. It doesn't mean we don't have other priorities and other supporting missions. But here at Fort Hunter Liggett, we have one primary role, and that is to make sure that we have a platform that enables our unit commanders to come here and be successful. Constantly, I'm looking at how we can upgrade and modify our ranges and training areas to really be more effective and provide a better platform for those commanders to train.
Tell us about your time in Hawaii.
Yeah, so Tom, I know that you visit Hawaii often. So as I mentioned, I did a tour in Hawaii where I was the chief of staff for the Army Reserve Engagement Cell. And the unique thing about that position was that it was an opportunity for me to really reach back and draw from the available Army Reserve units and resources to come out and support the Pacific and really provide realistic training for our units and our unit commanders to come out and be part of the theater of operation. Again,
out at Fort Shafter?
I was. I sat in an office in Fort Shafter, and I worked for the director of the Army Reserve Engagement Cell, a guy by the name of Brigadier General Alvin, Brian Alvin, which you may know was Major General Alvin, the commander of the 63rd Readiness Division, which was our senior commander prior to Major General Resende taking command.
Did you ever deal with Tropic Thunder?
I did quite a bit. The 25th Infantry Division. Yeah, yes, they were.
I did a show with them.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a while ago.
Yeah, so the 25th Infantry Division does a lot of training. I don't know if you know this. We have one infantry battalion in the Army Reserve, and it is located in Hawaii. That infantry battalion, Go For Broke, is located there, and they have a relationship with the 25th, and they train pretty regular with the 25th. So it's always interesting because they're always out there training with those guys. And because of a lot of our positions here are coded infantry, a lot of our folks rotate from Hawaii to the installation here to serve as part of our range cadre.
Colonel Charles Bell, closing thoughts on Veterans Day and everything we've been talking about.
Yeah, so I know we spent a lot of time talking about my story, but I really want to say that every soldier, past and present, has their own story and their service and sacrifice. And I want to take this opportunity to thank them for all they've done for our country and all they continue to do for our country. So, Tom, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for coming out and conducting this interview with me.
My honor and my pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett. Come along and join us as we visit with First Sergeant Unger. As you know, the reason I wanted to visit with you has to do with Veterans Day and what it means to you.
So Veterans Day to me is, you know, remembering our former veterans, and the original reason for Veterans Day was armistice. And so it's the stop of fighting.
Are you friends with many veterans?
I have several friends that are veterans now and current, and a lot that are previous veterans, or well, they're always veterans, but previously had served. My grandfather previously served, so yes.
So you grew up with the military model close to your heart and your family, literally.
Yes, sir.
Where did you grow up, and when and why did you join?
I grew up in Texas. I'd always wanted to join, always wanted to serve my country. That's the whole reason why I get up. That's why I continue to serve, is just giving back to the community, giving back to the country, giving back to those people that have lived and served before us.
A little bit more about you. You're a first sergeant.
Yes, sir.
So talk to us about your role and your duties.
My duties as a first sergeant are that of a generalist, to support my organization as a whole, to support the people, to make sure they have everything that they need, from food to money to anything that can support them or their families.
So you're like mayor in a sense.
I wouldn't go that glamorous. I'm more like the janitorial custodian that makes sure and cleans up all the issues that other people have kind of left for us.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been stationed at Fort Hunter Liggett?
I arrived here this summer, so I've only been here just a few months.
Mm-hmm. And you'll be here a couple of years?
Yes, sir. I'll be here two to three.
Yeah. And looking forward, what would you like to do? Where would you like to go?
Well, I serve at the convenience of the government and the Army.
Again, perfect world. Looking forward, your career, where would you like to go? What do you want to do?
I'm still young enough and have kids that are young enough that, you know, we're interested in traveling. We've been from the East Coast to the Central to now on the West Coast. So I'd be willing to go to other countries. I'd be willing to serve wherever that I'm sent. So I've got lots of opportunities in my career field.
And how long have you been active duty?
I've been with the Active Guard or Reserve program since 2011, and I've been in the service since 2003.
And looking forward, 20 years?
I take it day by day, but that's the goal, is to get 20 years and continue on into retirement and then transition into, you know, life after the military, continuing to find a way to serve.
Talk to us about the dynamic beyond your MOS and your daily duties, and that's family. That's your wife and kids. Mm-hmm. They live on base here at Fort Hunter Liggett, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, mm-hmm. We do live on base.
And so, how are they dealing? The kids like it here? They have fun adventures?
Well, Fort Hunter Liggett's a very friendly and an inviting place, so my kids can go out the front door and play with other children. You know, COVID's an interesting time period, but, you know, we are a close and tight community, so we can still play in those safe areas. Living in other places, I haven't always been able to do that. Mm-hmm. You have friends that are next door, but, you know, hey, somebody's always got to watch them, busy streets and all that other areas, but, you know, living on a military base with children, it's a great opportunity for those kids to be able to go play and kids to have great friends. And some friends that we had in previous bases, they continue to have, you know, years afterwards. So
they keep in touch?
Try to, yes. Yeah, yes, really absolutely.
Cool. And your wife, she having a good time? She's happy?
She does the best she can. Uh-huh. She's not an overly social creature, but she does enjoy the area to a point. And it's adjustment every time we move. And so,
there are a lot of activities that are put on for the families here on base. What are some of the fun activities the kids have done?
The MWR here does a really good job of trying to bring out everybody. So our kids have done programs with the Child and Youth Service Center. They've just reopened the bowling center, so that's a great thing that we plan on looking forward to with the children. There's always programs at the Hacienda that the kids like going to and having a fancy meal like Oktoberfest or anything like that. So just expanding their horizons of things that we wouldn't have had anywhere else if we wouldn't have been here.
Very cool. And again, looping back, where were you stationed before?
I was stationed at Fort Bragg, sir.
Okay. North Carolina.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Very cool. Final thoughts about veterans and what that means to you?
Veterans, it's a great appreciation that I have to be part of this community, that I have the opportunity to serve, you know, like I said, my country, the people that are in the country. And even though there's all kinds of craziness right now with COVID and, you know, elections, all of those different pieces, but we're all in the same country. We all still live here. We all pull together. And me being a veteran is able for me to serve back to my community and those people that are here, whether we have agreements or we don't. It's still all of us together.
Would you agree that the mission of the Army and the military is beyond and above politics? There's a greater good element.
Correct. Yes, I agree. That's the attitude of serving. Everybody has something that they look forward to, whether it's faith in humanity, faith in the other person that they know and they care about, or faith in a higher power. So, yes, I agree. All of those are greater than somebody who's individually elected or appointed or any of those things. We have that common bond.
First Sergeant Unger, thank you so much for sharing. It was great to meet you.
Thank you for your time, Tom. I appreciate you.
My pleasure. I'm Tom Willmer, reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett, where we've been speaking with First Sergeant Unger. An update on the world of COVID as it relates to the United States military.
Thanks, Tom. Again, nice seeing you, and thanks for coming out. Just to talk a little bit about COVID and talk a little bit about what we're doing here at Fort Hunter Liggett, we've been really successful. You know, we've learned how to operate in a COVID environment. We've learned how to continue our mission in this environment.
I know that mask wearing is super stringent. He wouldn't even look at my DOD pass until I put my mask on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly how we've been successful, is maintaining our health protection condition. So we've lowered our health protection condition to Bravo, but we've remained with the same protocols as we did when we were in health protection condition Charlie. And what that really means is that, just like we are now, we're like 6 or 7 feet apart. So we're maintaining social distance. We're wearing our masks. We're using our hand sanitizer. Our soldiers that are training here have to do the same thing. And then even before our soldiers arrive to training, we're contacting them 14 days prior. What we're doing is we're saying, hey, you're coming to Fort Hunter Liggett to train. How are you feeling? And we're going through the list of questions. You know, do you have a fever? Have you been around anybody with COVID? You know, the whole list of pre-screening questions. And then we're going back to them 5 days out saying, hey, I know we talked to you 14 days ago, but now we're 5 days out. I'm going to ask you this again. And then when they arrive, especially if they're flying in, our cadre here at the TTC meets them at the airport and does an in-person check, checks the temperature, pre-screening. And then when they get through our gate, we do it one more time. And so if there's any indication at any time in that process that somebody has been exposed or they're showing signs or symptoms, we segregate them from everybody else. Oh, yeah. I don't think anybody's been that safe. So we segregate those folks. We have them tested. And then they're quarantined in such a time that their test results come back and they're either negative or positive. If they're positive, then, of course, they stay in quarantine. We then call it isolation, but it's the same thing. But I can tell you, we've trained like 11, we're probably up to 12,000 soldiers across our garrison. I'd say probably upwards of 12,000 at this point. And we've had 8, 9 COVID cases from soldiers that are training here. A relatively small number when you consider the large number of soldiers that have trained here since the start of COVID. And the success that we had operating in the COVID environment, while our soldiers are here, we have a thing called a bubble, but really what it amounts to is a cohort. We separate them in cohorts so that if there is a issue, that it's isolated to that cohort. You know, even though those folks are in a cohort, they still have to wear masks, socially distance, use hand sanitizer. So Tom, I'll tell you that for the large number of soldiers that we've trained on our installation, we've had a relatively small number of COVID cases.
A literal handful.
A small number, single digits. So,
okay. Colonel Charles Bell, thank you for sharing. I really appreciate it.
Again, Tom, always nice to see you. Thanks for coming out, and look forward to seeing you again.
Well, I look forward to. I'm Tom Willmer, reporting from Fort Hunter, Liggett in Monterey County, where we've been visiting with Base Commander Colonel Charles Bell.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.